Please do start.
So good afternoon. I'd like to first thank the Attorneys General and John Palfrey and all the members of the committee and for the great work they're doing here for the, to help protect kids online. So I'm Peter Ferrioli, and I'm Director of Operations at NetNanny. Has anyone out here not heard of NetNanny? Okay. So let me dispel everything you do think about it or know about it right now. So NetNanny is, we're basically a parental control tool. We are a tool to help empower parents to block, filter, monitor what their kids are doing online and various aspects of all the different things they do online currently, whether or not that's blocking peer-to-peer downloads, that's blocking inappropriate content, that's blocking inappropriate contact, that's managing the time they spend online, who they're chatting with, what they're saying, etc. So NetNanny was pretty much the very first internet parental control back in circa 92, 93, around when everyone was using Netscape as their browser and Mosaic and those fun days back then. And NetNanny, our new version, actually NetNanny 6, after 2.5 years of having the same version out and small versionings coming out, we'll have our next version out next week. So you guys will be the first group to hear about three or four of the killer features that we don't think anyone else is doing in this space and that we're ahead of the game in. We have, just in the last 4 years, we have about 750,000 plus users, consumers using NetNanny parental controls. So that doesn't take into account from years 1993 to about 2003 when we had the first four versions out. And I hope no one's still using those. If you are, contact me, I'll upgrade you. So we are a very flexible and powerful filter that allows what content is appropriate based on family members' age that comes into their house. We use a patent pending dynamic contextual analysis filtering engine. Now, what does that mean? Well, that basically means that unlike the majority of filters out there today that are using list-based mechanisms that we find quite antiquated, we use an engine, an algorithm that we develop that basically allows us to analyze a page on the fly as it's loaded into the browser, determine its content, and then based on a user's settings, whether they want to block, warn, or allow that page, we can apply that policy to that page and that content. So this is when I was doing these slides and got the template, they asked for some quantitative data here. This is just two recent things when we talk about underblocking and overblocking in our industry. Those are two of the key things that like to get thrown around about how effective and ineffective a content filter actually is. You can see here that recently, the IIA in Australia tested NetNanny, and you can see some of the results here that on correct blocking, we were 98% and 3% overblocked on websites. And then when we had a test just recently, we took seven of our competing products out there. We applied the same list of 4,500 websites, and we ran them through all the filters to get accuracy, and we came out with about a 96.2 correct blocking and 4.3% overblocking. And that's just a little bit on just the filter side of what we do. I'm going to talk just a little bit about NetNanny 6.0 next week, what comes out, and some of the things that we're looking forward to. We partnered with the ESRB, so we will be the first desktop software client to actually block PC games based on the ESRB ratings and the content descriptors of those games. So you can choose to play T for T games, but if you decide within that category that you don't want your children on their PC to play games that have sex, but then you can just block sex. If you're okay with violence, you can allow violence. So we've not only based it on the age ratings of the ESRB, which you can select, but we've also based it on the content descriptors that the ESRB provides for games. That's one new feature in NetNanny 6.0. Another new feature in NetNanny 6.0 is the ability to filter and block secure proxy websites. Now, this is actually a huge leap forward for us. Over many years and many of these conferences, including ones that deal with the NECC and technology, what you find out is that parental desktop filters have a bad rap because everyone assumes that a child can enter a proxy website, which they do currently with today's most desktop filters in schools, and they can circumvent that filter easily. And they can do that. We have been aggressive with that behavior, and our new version will actually block secure proxy websites, and we'll be able to actually filter the content and understand what's going on. Currently today, we block just proxy websites. We have an algorithm that can determine if a site is a proxy and block it. But we're taking that to the next step, and no one on the client side is doing this. This is done right now on an enterprise side. You can see this on some of the back-end appliance solutions that are done with internet filters and content filters, but you haven't seen it on the client side desktop yet. Those are two of the major features. Another one will be instant message alert and analysis. So we've partnered with, we've worked with several cyberbullying experts in the U.S., a couple of them, and criminal professors, and we've taken logs and looked at what cyberbullies do, what they say. We've looked at years of parents who have had kids cyberbullied, submitted things to us. We developed an algorithm in NetNanny that allows any instant message application at this point to send an alert if somebody uses a word or phrase or in a certain style, if they go back and forth in a conversation in the context of, let's say they want to meet, let's say they're giving racial hatred speech, hate speech, any kind of harassing speech, we can just alert parents via real-time email alert that that's occurring in context, then they can have a conversation with their children. I should step back a little bit. NetNanny does not, we don't install stealth, we're not a stealth mode keylogger or anything like that. We're all about educating and open communication between parents and their kids about taking responsibility about what they do online. Now we know that some of Adam Thera's great work back there on parental controls, that only 1 out of 10 parents who have access to free parental controls today on their cable, their DirecTV, their cell phones, their computer, only 1 in 10 actually uses them. So people say, oh, well, NetNanny is, you know, a subscription product, or if you have to buy something for $39.95. Well, the fact is that 90% of people with access aren't using the free ones that they currently have. So what that says a couple things. That says that the ease of use of parental controls and the education are what are very key about parental controls. Lastly, we have a social network dashboard that we're rolling out next week. What that will enable a parent to do from any remote place that they are at work on their desktop, they can log into their NetNanny account and they can see a little profile of all the different social networks that their kid has gone to, what's changed on there. We can flag items, we can show pictures, and we've worked with a couple of those social networks in particular. And am I being
Thank
enough?
You. You are. Okay, that's great. Thank you, though. I appreciate it, Peter. Stay up. I know it's particularly hard for those with very mature products such as yours that you've got so many problems you're trying to solve to get it into 5 minutes, but I appreciate your trying. Questions for Content Watch and NetNanny? How about any of the... Yes, please. Let's get a mic over here. And please tell us who you are. Jess Tatlock, the...
I can say one last quick thing about we solved the social networks about the alcohol and tobacco. Well, with NetNanny, you don't have to worry about your kids being exposed to any of that on social networks today. So,
my name is Denise Pillow, and I have a small business called Kids Be Safe Online. I educate parents and educators on internet safety and everything about kids and technology. So my question to you is, you talked about the IM alert analysis by keyword selection. Who sets those keyword selections?
Well, it's actually, keywords are just a small part of it, and those, we've taken logs over many years from various experts, whether it was based on online predatory behavior or bullying behavior, and we've based the algorithm around a lot of that, around a lot of real world incidents that have occurred and triggers that led up to those, and patterns that parents wish they could have seen in the chats previously before harmful incidents occurred to their children or things that got out of their control. So, well, it's based on a lot of things. It's based about the timing in between the messages, how many times it's coming from them. Certain keywords in it are one part of it, for sure.
So they are able to select themselves, and also you have recommended selections?
No, you can't enter your own keywords. No, not currently.
Okay.
You cannot.
That was the question.
Thank you. I see John Morris has his hand up, but may I defer to someone who has not yet had a chance, or fewer chances? Maybe we'll start back here and we'll come to John. So we'll go Adam, then gentleman from ChatSafe, and then up to John.
Just real quick, Peter, you answered this question for me earlier. Maybe you can just tell the crowd how NetNanny handles the new incognito mode in the Google Chrome browser as well as in private browsing in Internet Explorer, right?
That's a really good question.
That's an question right there.
Yeah, we've been getting that question. I had to talk to a reporter at Times UK, and let's just put this to rest right now. With NetNanny, those modes do not exist. The only thing, what that means is that because they're in the incognito mode does not mean if you have NetNanny installed, you can still track wherever they've gone through your reporting. So we work at the port level, whereas these browsers are working at the browser level. They're basically looking at your history, your cache, the cookies, et cetera, and they're putting a report there. So in incognito mode, all this stuff is not tracked or wiped away, but with NetNanny installed, you can still track all the websites they've visited to, and we do have plans to implement a plugin that would lock the private mode out of a browser. So today, with NetNanny, you install it, you can lock Google into safe search mode, so your kids cannot get out of safe search mode. We will be doing the same thing when it comes to browsers and the private ability of those.
Great, and I should give, if John Burchett or others from Google want to talk to the Chrome issue at any point, just raise your hand. Sir.
Jim Carmichael, Carmichael Technologies, ChatSafe. Just a question for clarification. If a child is moving to another desktop, to a friend, some more down the street or whatever, how does NetNanny handle that situation?
Well, if my son goes to a neighbor who doesn't have NetNanny, I recommend they put NetNanny on their computer.
That's a good sales tactic right there. Very well done. Let's go. John Morris, because he's been waiting, and then Larry. And if anybody from the TAB wants to raise their hand, I'll look over there next.
But if let me just seriously address that for 1 second. Everyone knows about cloud computing and, you know, software as a service, and we haven't heard a lot about that today, but I'm not going to say that, you know, we're quite there yet with that, but to address that issue in particular, that's the way that it looks like it's going to be addressed, no matter where that child goes. Hopefully there's some type of proxy service that if the school is using it, you know, their ISPs are using it, et cetera, that they'd be blocked everywhere if they didn't have a local parental control.
But you're not saying you have a cloud computing solution?
I am there. Not saying
right.
That.
Great. Just to be clear.
John Morris, CDT. Your product allows various reports to go back to parents about their kids' activity. How many of those reports go through your servers, and what information do you retain about that, if any?
That's a great question. So what we do is when a profile is set up on NetNanny, we basically we sync that profile to our back-end servers. We only keep any data for 30 days. Every 30 days, all data is purged. We basically only keep chat logs if that feature is selected, if you want to log chat for 30 days, and if you would like to, any URL that was visited, we keep that for 30 days as well, and then those are purged.
Larry, you may have to turn it on from the bottom.
Let me just say the reason we do that on the back end, we sync it, is so that if you have multiple computers, you can then sync that profile out to wherever your child is, where NetNanny is.
Hi, Larry Maggot, Connect Safely. Depending on the data you look at, anywhere from 50% to fewer parents use filtering technology like NetNanny. You guys have been on the market for many years. It's a very mature technology. Why is it that you think that the uptake of the technology across the board is not as high as perhaps some people might expect or might want?
Well, there's a couple of education and ease of use. If I can make it those simple words, that's why. With great education, like the things you're doing and some of the NGOs, and with the ease of use of parental controls, for instance, next week we release a whole new feature where you just select what age your child is and you'll get a pre-canned set of policies. So if you choose a young child, you put them in a walled garden. If you chose a teen and you want to enable them to social network and chat, all those policies would be preset. So we're trying to make it an easier to use product, and we're trying to also educate parents about using the product.
But what about the possibility that a certain number of parents have thought it through but have decided they don't want it, they don't need it, it isn't necessary, they have other means to keep their kids from doing inappropriate things? I mean, have you looked at those numbers as well?
Yeah, but we, when we talk about filtering content and doing inappropriate things, this is pretty straightforward, is that a few of the top revenue generators online are pornography, gambling, and prescription pills. Now, I don't know about anybody else out there, but I don't want that content being pushed to me all the time. So when I installed the filter on our home, and my son says, why'd you put this on there to stop me from doing whatever? It had nothing to do with my son. It has everything to do with protecting the family from content we don't want to come into our house. And I think if everyone understands that, not kind of wants to point filtering at, well, this is going to stop Johnny from, you know, going to Playboy.com, versus, well, this actually allows us to hold our morals and values in our household and allows it to come in there. You know, it's just a different way of looking at it, I think.
So go Honey Fried, and then I think Wendy Seltzer is trying to get in on the conversation, be my guest, so we'll go in that order.
So we have a 3-4% of overblocking. What mechanism do we have once something is overblocked to unblock it?
There is, well, so if you come to That's a great question. So we have an override situation where either the child using the product is given a separate override password by the parent, or we can email in real time the fact that your child wants to access the site, it's been blocked. Maybe it shouldn't have. Maybe CNN today is running a story on pornography, and the word pornography is showing up 20 times on CNN, so our filter blocks it. So that day, a child needs to get that article from CNN. They can override it instantly from a password from their parent or via an email that's sent to their parent in real time. Their parent can do it remotely.
Honey, is that responsive? Wendy Seltzer.
Thanks. Since the first question that I had was already asked about how many parents might actively be choosing not to use these products, I'll move on to another one, which is how do we prevent these products from preemptively blocking the new and the unseen? As you say, you're developing newer, better technologies to block out the proxies and the circumvention attempts and the places where kids might go to sites that can embed content from other sites or include content that would therefore appear to be a clean URL up top, but in pieces from other sites that the parent has chosen to block. How do you avoid blocking new uses of technology?
Well, I don't think I understand your question completely. If you're so we have a dynamic engine basically. So if an hour ago you decide to post on your blog something about, let's just take any one of the categories that we have predefined that we block on. Let's say it's hate speech, or you decide that you don't want your kids to learn about drugs or how to make meth. So you decide you're going to block that, but you post a blog about it an hour ago. That goes to load into the browser. It gets blocked on the fly because we're able to analyze the page and categorize it. So if something is overblocked, we're not that concerned. I mean, we don't overblock things, but we would be more concerned if we were underblocking. Overblocking, an override is an easy thing. It's a click of a button to get to the website. And if we underblock, that's bad. We're trying to prevent the exposure in the first place.
Wendy, just a tiny follow-up, and then we'll go.
Okay. The question was, do those overblocks interfere with sort of Web 2.0-ish content?
No, not with our engine. With a list-based antiquated filter, it does. If I'm using a filter that's relying on 3 million bad known porn URLs that tomorrow are something different, then it's a problem.
All right. Please join me in thanking Content Watt Nani. And if we could welcome our friends from Symantec. Thank you. And just to be clear, as Symantec sets up, we've moved into a category we've called here filtering auditing. Again, I'd urge you to look at the submissions related to what problems each of the providers say they're solving. So all but one, I think, was checked off in the NetNanny submission. So don't be the fact that we categorize in this way doesn't mean to limit or to, in fact, create any expectation about what it's solving. Sir.
Hi, my name is Keith Neustadt. I'm a software developer at Symantec working on Norton Family Safety.
Can you get closer to the...
Oh, sorry. Can you hear me now? Is that better? So again, I'm Keith Neustadt. I'm a software developer at Symantec. I'm working on Norton Family Safety. We feel that Norton Family Safety takes a different approach to parental controls, in large part by focusing on providing parents with the tools that they need in order to foster a positive relationship with their kids in the context of online safety. So we all know it's why we're here. We all know that there's a lot of different dangers that face kids as they go online. And that could be anything from accidentally viewing content on the web that's not appropriate for them to being targets of online predators or cyber bullies. So we feel that in combating this, there's a couple of approaches that we need to take. I mean, certainly we need to have activity controls at the client on the child's machine to provide sort of boundaries, you know, things that they're not supposed to do versus things that they are expected to do and that they should be allowed to do and that they should be encouraged to do. But at the same time, we feel that it's really important to provide the visibility to the parent into the child's online life. Now, so for example, suppose my daughter goes to Google and starts searching for things that are associated with eating disorders. Now, it's probably less important to me that this that these searches get blocked than that I'm informed about it, right? So the actual response is to basically to give me the information I need so that I can open that kind of dialogue with my child. So now this idea of visibility is kind of a tricky one because parents these days don't have a whole lot of time, and they're not able to provide a physical presence at the child's computer whenever the child is online. And from the parents that we've talked to, a lot of them don't want to, even if they could. They want their kids, particularly the older kids, to feel like they have a sense of privacy in their online life, whether it's browsing the web or talking to their friends. So we feel that it's important that a parental controls application like Norton Family Safety provides the parent with the granularity and configuration to decide what's the appropriate level of blocking or monitoring for the kid. Maybe a younger kid, we monitor everything and we block everything that's inappropriate. Maybe for an older child, we monitor less. We give them more privacy. We give them more leeway to make their own decisions. But we still want to get notified when something happens that might be an indicator of something that we need to address. So in the end, the goal is to provide the parents with tools and the child also with the tools to create a relationship with each other that allows them to together make sure that the child is safe online. So this is how it would work. The parent goes to the Norton Family Safety website and sets up an account and defines their family. Then the parent sits down with the child and together they define the rules. So this is full disclosure. The child knows what's expected of them, what kind of monitoring is going to be in place. This is not spyware, right? In the meantime, the child also gets a sense of ownership of the process. They're there to try to influence the rules, and there's a certain a level of buy-in that they've agreed to these rules. When they go back to their computer, they can at any time view basically that contract that they agreed to that defines what their parents' expectations of are of them when they're online. So now the child goes back to their own computer and they engage in the activities that they usually do, browsing the web, searching the web, chatting with their friends, using social networks. But in the meantime, the parent has the ability to, from wherever they are, whether it's another computer in the home or maybe from work, they have the ability to get a sense of what's going on for the child in their online life and to get notifications if something maybe problematic comes up. So suppose that the child goes to a website that they're not supposed to, something that they've agreed that they're not going to go to. Well, the parent's going to get a notification and has the opportunity to, again, open up that dialogue, has the information to open up that dialogue. At the same time, the child is informed that they've done something that transgresses this contract that they have. And they have an opportunity to also open up a dialogue with their parent about that. Now, maybe for a younger child, they actually get blocked. They actually can't go see that website. And so they've got an opportunity to, you know, maybe type in a note to their parent to say, sorry, I didn't know what I was clicking on. An accident. And that's going to show up in the logs for the parent in the parent's console, so they get a little bit more context. Or if it's an older child, maybe the parent has decided that that they're going to give the child the leeway to make their own decision. Well, they're still going to get a notification. The child is still going to get a notification on the client saying, you're doing something that might not be appropriate. Are you sure you want to do this? And again, the child has the opportunity to open up a dialogue with their parent. This is the reason I'm going here. Maybe it was an accident. I clicked on a link. I didn't know where I was going to go. Or maybe there's actual content that I validly need to access to do schoolwork. And they also have the opportunity to request permission to go see that site if they're blocked. And again, the parent, from wherever they are, maybe at work, they get the notification. They can see what's going on. They get the context. There's that dialogue that's opened up. They can choose whether or not to allow the request or deny the request. And again, it's about providing the parent with the tools that they need to understand what the child is doing online and whether or not there's something that they need to do to personally intervene. So, and then beyond that, again, there's a focus on providing parents with the tools that they need in order to parent. So also access to forums where parents can share ideas and issues, access to other online content that helps parents with this task of parenting in an online world.
Great, thank you so much for this overview. Do you mind if I use moderator's prerogative and ask the first question? We've had the target again of our inquiry on social network sites, but we're talking about it more broadly, and I appreciate very much that you're looking at instant messaging and other kind of environments that we might have concern with. But can you maybe just talk to the social network example, and let's imagine that I, with my child, set up this arrangement to limit what he or she could do within the social network. What are the kinds of constraints that this product would place on his or her activity?
Right. So I'm going to have to apologize up front. We're still sort of in the depths of development, and we're still haggling over what features are in and out. So there's some things I'm not going to be able to be specific about.
Okay.
But for
and this
social,
is one of them?
For social networking, I can still answer your question.
Okay. Thanks.
So for social networking, at the sorry. So for social networking, certainly there's going to be parts of this contract that are going to define, for example, which sites the parent is comfortable with a child visiting and which sites they're not. We're also going to be monitoring to see which sites the child is using, not just for browsing, but which sites they actually have accounts on. And we'll be collecting information, again, configurable by the parent, about, you know, what the site is, what the URL is, what their screen name is, you know, the age that they're purporting to be on that site, that sort of thing. So again, the goal is to give the parent enough information to create that dialogue. So maybe the parent has blocked access to a particular social networking site. The child has the opportunity to ask for permission, right? Maybe the child has permission to get to a certain social networking website, but has created multiple accounts when they're only really supposed to have one. Well, the parent is going to know this, right, and is going to have the opportunity to engage in that conversation, and in particular to make sure that they're on the child's friend list, that they've got visibility into what's going on.
Got it. Thanks very much. I'll start with Teresa, unless there's someone. Oh, Scott Bradner has not yet spoken, which is extraordinary, other than having people come to the mic, and we'd like to hear from him. Tell us who you are, Scott.
Scott Bradner, one of the TAB members, work for Harvard. How much research have you done to gauge the level of ongoing parental involvement in this sort of thing? It could be quite a bit of ongoing effort.
About how much effort is required from
No, how many parents, what percentage of parents stick with it?
So we're a version one product.
Okay.
Right.
So the answer is not much yet.
Well, we've done research in talking to parents about what they're looking for, and the types of things that we found is that a question came up earlier, why aren't parental controls being adopted more? And I think that a lot of the other reasons that came up apply, but I think that one of them that hasn't come up yet is that parents are hesitant to be viewed as spying on their kids, right? Maybe, particularly as kids get older. And then another reason is that the amount of information that you get when you are monitoring in detail what a kid is doing is a little bit overwhelming, particularly to a parent who might not be as technically savvy as the child, right? So, you know, list of URLs and search terms, and they don't necessarily know what that means. So it's a little bit overwhelming. So what we've gotten is that parents of younger children really want to be able to constrain what the kids can do and to have full visibility into it, whereas parents of older children want to give the child more free rein, more freedom, more privacy, but they still want to get notified. They don't want to see everything, but they still want to get notified when there's something that they might want to address. Again, the example of the girl who's searching for terms associated with eating disorders. I don't want to block that. I want to know about it.
Yeah, the reason I ask is not that I completely agree with you. This is the kind of thing that parents would say they wanted. The question is how well would they stick to it. And so because your product is new, it's hard to tell. But it's certainly one of the areas of worry.
Something to monitor. Teresa Pelouris.
Teresa Pelouris from Polytechnic University of NYU. You had mentioned in one of your slides that in stark contrast to other approaches, and you were emphasizing your reliance on the parental involvement and monitoring. How are you doing that in a way that's different, say, from the example before with NetNanny?
I think that it's I think it's in large part to the way we approach the problem, right? The context of an online world is new, right? Children going out and interacting with other people online, engaging in behaviors that might not be appropriate, exchanging information that might not be appropriate. But this is kind of an old problem. This is something that existed before the internet, which is basically parents asking themselves, I know how to parent my kid when I'm there. You know, how do I parent my kid when they're out in the world, right? So a lot of it is about the approach, and a lot of it is about providing tools that, you know, it's not about installing an agent on the child's machine and laying down the law and saying, these are the rules that I'm imposing on you. It's about making sure there's a continual back and forth discussion between the parent and the child and having the software facilitate that. So what the child is doing online and how effective the rules are, how appropriate the rules are, a continual conversation.
I guess my question was relating to how does the package support that, though?
I'm going to apologize for being vague, but with certain workflow items like the child being able to see a natural language view of what their contract is and what they've agreed to, which experts in the field of parenting online say is very important. Also, workflow that allows children and parents to communicate within the context of the parental controls, right? The web page doesn't just come up and say, you can't do this. The web page comes up and says, you're doing something you're not supposed to do. Why is that? Let's engage.
Brian Levine of UMass.
Thank you. So I want to really applaud the approach of integrating parents into this. I think that's great. But I wanted to ask you a question about data security. Mm-hmm. So it seems that the information you gather about children and so on is in a central location stored with Symantec, and I guess that's because you want parents to be able to access those logs from work, say, things like that. Mm-hmm. But how long is that data kept, and can parents delete it upon request, and is that information ever sold to third parties?
So, again, on the specifics, I'm not going to be exactly sure with what we come up with. Certainly, the data is going to be purged regularly. The data will never be sold. Symantec, this is not the only scenario where Symantec keeps customer data in the cloud for them, right? It's not even in consumer products. I mean, we've done it for a long time in enterprise products too. So this is something that we're familiar with. We certainly don't collect any information without permission. The parent always has the option to turn off at a pretty good granularity what's being stored, what's not, right? And we've got lots of experience on how to make sure that data is secure when it's in our possession.
So is it typical if there was a data breach at Symantec that you would notify your customers?
I'm going to say this, and maybe I'm going to get slammed. I don't believe that's happened yet.
That you've notified them, or that you've had the breach?
That we've had the breach.
Uh-huh.
But I would assume yes. That's with a caveat. I'm a software developer.
Yes. All right. Yes. The crew from Symantec steps up. Thank you, Owen. That away. This is good. Clarity, defensive. Jeff Smith.
This is okay. Has that information ever been subpoenaed?
Harder. No.
Yeah. That's actually an easy one for me. I have no idea. I don't know.
Do you guys care to respond? Okay. That may also, for lawyers, be hard to answer, even if it were so. Professor Harry Lewis, author of Blown to Bits, which if you have not read it, you ought to.
Thank you, John. I'm a computer science professor at Harvard. I'd just like to offer, this is not aimed at you, it's aimed at a number of the comments that have been made in the discussion of why parents don't use these monitoring tools, whether covert or overt, as yours are, and I certainly agree that of the two, the open posture you've taken is preferable. But there are parents who simply believed that the developmentally more healthy way to have a trusting relationship with your child is to have the child understand that the child has certain privacy that the parents will not, in fact, invade, and that the attempts to monitor, since they will inevitably be circumvented by going down the street or whatever, is better assured to the child from the first place, and that the discussion which the parent and the child need to have is about the responsibilities that are being placed on both parties by having that happen. So it's not so much fear or avoidance or many of the other sort of negative externalities that have been associated with that, but it's actually an attempt to help children grow up.
I think it's worth noting that in addition to being a parent, he is also the former dean of Harvard College. So we had 6,400 such charges under his giving. Do you want to respond to this or others who may have been invoked?
All I can say is that I totally agree. We very much agree.
Great. Any other questions? I feel the energy sapping slightly from the room after all these great presentations. But I will do one more from Larry, and then we'll move forward.
First of all, I want to ditto that last comment. That was the nature of my question earlier. The other issue is, to the extent to which this is going to be effective, it's going to be effective in families where the parent is actively engaged in their children's life. And ironically, that's probably the place where it's least needed, or where some form of protection is least needed. And so I know you're an engineer, and I know you can't solve every problem in the world, but I wonder if you could at least talk about the child who comes from a home where the parents are unable or unwilling or just simply ill-equipped to provide supervision, the very homes where to the extent that online predation is a risk, the very homes where it apparently there may be some risk. What do we do about the folks that aren't going to rush over to Best Buy to spend money and spend time to supervise their parents? There's a lot of parents in that category.
So you're asking, how do we protect children whose parents
don't buy your service?
Are not.
Yeah, maybe that's not a fair question for you.
Yeah. So I'm going to redirect it, if that's okay. Can I send Esther Hargitay? Do you mind being on the spot for a moment if I rephrase the question for you? So, sorry, and maybe I'll welcome them. Actually, let's thank Symantec. It's very helpful. Welcome McGruff to the podium. And while you set up, thank you. I'm going to ask Esther Hargitay. Someone who's done a huge amount of study, as of Dana and others, particularly on this question of the participation gap in terms of the skills that kids have and whether or not kids may be on SES lines or maybe otherwise, if you're willing to go down that road, may be more or less at risk. And
it's definitely the case that I've studied differences in young users' skills. And there are huge differences in what younger users understand about the web. So while on average younger users are more knowledgeable than older adults, there are huge differences among them. And as John cited, these tend to be along lines of socioeconomic status, race, ethnicity, gender. So you can't assume that all young users are very savvy, and it is systematic as to who is more or less savvy. This does raise concerns because one way I measure SES is parental education. And so what you have is kids who are in families where parents have lower levels of education, the kids themselves understand the web less. So the fear there would be that the parents would understand these risks less themselves, and the kids themselves would be more prone to those issues. But I'm afraid I haven't really worked on solutions to those. My area is more trying to figure out what we can do through training, but that's actually a really tricky issue itself.
Esther's got tons of great data, relatively fresh from the field, and to the extent you want to dig into that, I know she'll be around. McGruff, thank you so much for being here.
Hi, my name's Marty Schultz, and I'm with McGruff Safeguard. I want to kind of reiterate what the Attorney General said this morning, which is that no solution is perfect, and we need to empower the parents to keep their kids safe online. And that's what we do. We give parents a simple, free, easy-to-use tool that empowers them to keep their kids safe. The problem, we believe, is not just age verification, because even if we verify the kid's age, they'll figure out some way to get around the verification. The problem is not the internet or social networks. We can't stop progress, and social networks are beginning to become a fabric of society. The problem is not the existence of bad guys out there, because there are bad guys, and that's just a reality that we have to live with. The problem is parental ignorance and parental apathy. Parents don't know how to keep those kids safe online. That's what we're all fighting about here. So our solution is to give parents the ability to monitor their kids online just like they monitor the kids in the real world. We have an intelligent virtual parenting service. It's free, it's from a trusted brand, and it alerts parents to potential danger. We knew in order to get massive desktop adoption out there amongst all people, it had to be free, it had to be trusted, the McGruff brand is very well trusted, and it had to be, as we've all pointed out, very, very simple to use. So how do we use the product? You sign up for an account for free at the McGruff website, you download and install a little applet on your kid's PC, McGruff monitors everything coming and going on the kid's PC so we see exactly what the kid is doing, and then if there's ever a problem, the parent is alerted via email or a cell phone text message that there's a problem, the parent signs into the website and sees what the kid's doing. We monitor everything, email, website, chat, social networks, you name it, we're doing it. When a parent first signs up, they say what kind of behaviors concern themselves about their child. Do they want to watch out for sexual predators? Do they want to watch out for drugs? Do they want to watch out for self-destructive behavior? They put in that profile, and then McGruff Safeguard will watch out for those activities. Here's an example from one of our customers where the kid used the word hot ice in a conversation. What McGruff Safeguard did was it noticed that's a term for crystal meth, sent a cell phone message to the parent saying, hey, you better get into the website and look what your kid's talking about because this could be potentially dangerous. Parent logs in, sees the conversation, and then has the conversation with the child to avoid a potentially dangerous issue with crystal meth. Now, before we go there, what we notice is now we have tens of thousands of parents coming to visit the McGruff Safeguard website every day to see what their kids are doing. We realize we have a community of parents who are watching out and really care about their children. So we said, why don't we take the power of that community and use it to stop sexual predators from targeting the children? So we added another feature, which is now covered by a patent we just got a few months ago, where, let's say John sees a predator talking to his daughter, and he reviews the conversation, said, this is a real predatory incident. Pushes a little button saying, report predator. At that point, we put John through a vetting process, calling him up, talking about it, and if we determine that this is a real report, not only do we block that predator from communicating with his daughter, we block that predator from talking to any other child protected by McGruff Safeguard. At the same time, we initiate a real criminal investigation by passing this information over to the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children. So by working together and taking and harnessing the combined power of all these parents who are watching over their children, we've kind of changed the tables on the sexual predators. They're no longer swimming in a sea of anonymity, which they are today. We're having tens of thousands of parents who are watching out for them, able to stop them, report them to the police, and protect their kids. We believe that parents need to monitor what their kids are doing online as the same way they do in the real world. We believe that monitoring needs to be simple and smart, and we believe that the social networking firms and the chat firms who provide these methods for kids to talk to each other need to cooperate with the security firms like ourselves and NetNanny and SpectreSoft. In essence, our request is really open up channels so that we can help parents see what their kids are doing online. I guess if we had one major request here for some of the social network companies to take away, excuse my notes, is that if we can cooperate, the companies who are in the parental control market and the people who provide social networking and provide these venues for parents to see what their kids are doing, it'll make the kids safer online. And I know in some cases that it's a business threat for parents to see everything their kids are doing, but we think that threat is worth, that risk is worth taking to keep the kids safer.
Thank you so much. Questions for McGraw? We'll maybe start with Scott over there, and then we'll do the Larry and John show over here after that.
The same questions are asked of the other folks that do a centralized collection. How long do you keep it? Who has access to it? Has it ever been subpoenaed?
The data is stored encrypted. It's kept for 30 days. Parents can delete it at their own volition.
And has it ever been...
It's never been compromised.
Has never been subpoenaed?
Never been subpoenaed.
If you're using it indirectly to engage law enforcement on to track down predators, do you provide any of that data to the law enforcement?
We've been advised by the National Crime Prevention Council and our other law enforcement assistance, because we partner with them, that we are a remote storage facility, and if the parent chooses to give this data to the police, they can.
But that wasn't the question I asked. Do you provide, in the context of bringing in law enforcement, do you provide any of this data to the law enforcement? Or do you just provide a screen name for the predator?
We provide the information to the parent. We assist them in filing the police report, and then we let the parent gain access to their own data. We basically give them the tools, then get out of the way so as not to mess up the investigation.
So you don't file a report, the parent does?
The report is filed on behalf of the parent.
By you? The parent initiates it through you?
Yeah, in other words, they push the button and our servers talk to NCMEC servers. And the parent is the one whose name is on the report.
But I'm just trying to ascertain how clear it is. What information is being provided to law enforcement when the parent presses the button? Does the parent have control over that? If so, how clean is the control?
It's the standard form that NCMEC has up on their cyber tip line. So it's the same information that's collected there.
There we go. Is that on now? No? Okay, I'll just use this. Other questions from anybody?
Yes. Sure.
Do we have...
So John Morris from CDT. So in the collaborative process, if you receive a report that a certain user is a predator and you receive it from two or three different McGruff users, but you're not able to reach them to verify it, what will you do with that kind of report? In other words, how much of a denial of service attack is risk is there through that system?
If a parent chooses not to go through the vetting process or aborts the vetting process and wishes not to file, in essence, a false police report, it's held. If we notice a pattern there, we'll certainly contact the vendor from which that conversation came, be it a Facebook, a MySpace, an MSN, or an AIM, to notify their security desks. But that's not enough for us to actually turn the report over to NCMEC or law enforcement.
Okay.
How many of these reports have you filed? How many of your thousands of users?
I think we've had about 8 reports filed off to NCMEC. 8 reports came into us, and about 3 have been forwarded off to NCMEC. I don't know what happened from that point.
3 have actually gone to full process.
Yes.
Out of how many thousands of users?
Out of tens of thousands of users.
Okay. Do we have further back here, Jeff?
Not-for-profit. Is there a revenue model here, or is this all funded by... there's a lot of...
We are an affiliate of the National Crime Prevention Council, McGruff. We are a for-profit organization. McGruff Safeguard is a for-profit corporation. We're an affiliate of the National Crime Prevention Council. The business model is an upgrade model where the product is given away for free, and some percentage of the parents choose to get some additional features for a small amount of money.
Okay.
Okay.
So just to clarify, I'm Jim Carmichael, ChatSafe. Step number one there is the result of the parent being diligent enough to monitor and see that there are telltale signs in the exchanges.
Software has linguistic analysis built in to detect predatory trends. So we would send an alert to the parent saying, we know you haven't come to the website for 2 months because you think everything's okay, but we just detected an incident that follows the patterns of grooming.
Excellent.
All right. Are there any other questions from the audience? Sure.
Did you say it's... Oh, I'm sorry. I'm Sahara Byrne from Cornell University.
Did you say that it was it's humans who are monitoring it, or is it some sort of software or algorithm?
Our software does linguistic analysis to monitor it, to warn parents that they better go in and verify what we're assuming is going on.
So it's software through linguistic.
Anyone else? All right. Thank you very much again. Thank you. We welcome KB up. Absolutely. We've made up a few minutes. It's sort of amazing.
Okay. Hopefully the energy will return to the room.
Absolutely. Anybody needs to do jumping jacks, please feel free. More coffee in the back.
Do you want to take the 5 minutes to let people stretch or just keep on?
I think let's just keep on and encourage people to stick with us.
Okay, my name is Paul Reamer. I'm the CEO of KB Technologies. I'd like to thank John and the rest of the task force for inviting us to talk with you today. Also, thanks, John, for limiting us to 3 slides. If we had our own way, we'd really have PowerPoint overload. I'm here today to talk about KB, a company based in San Francisco. We were formed 2 years ago this month when we saw how social media publishers were having trouble coping with the tremendous amount of user-generated content that was coming into their sites. Now, while these publishers were happy to get all this action, including the revenue that goes along with it, the methods that they put in place to protect their users from inappropriate content were sometimes an afterthought and frankly not very effective and not very scalable. When you think about it, these companies could meet all 3 of their business objectives, which are really safety, member experience, and monetization, if they could do a simple thing, which is enforce their own terms of service. After all, the terms of service expressly prohibit all the types of things that everybody in this room is concerned about. So enforcing them really would be the key to this. Recognizing this, KB's mission has always been quite simple. We want to help social media companies, we want to provide them with the best technologies for helping them to enforce their terms of service. So in September of 2006, we started developing our KB moderation suite, and 2 years and about 25 man years of development later, KB is becoming the de facto independent standard for content moderation and terms of service enforcement. At its heart, the KB moderation suite is a workflow solution that enhances human moderation teams' ability to get through content accurately and quickly. And these human moderation teams can be employees of our customers, they can be outsourced firms either in the US or offshore, or they can even be KB people that are provided as part of a complete solution to these customers. And here's how it works. Our customers connect to our system through a very simple API, typically takes just a few days to get this integration to work. Then content is fed into the KB system via the API, where it's analyzed and queued up for action by the human moderators. The decisions of the moderators, such as accept, reject, blacklist, whitelist, are then passed back to our customer servers, where they can take whatever action they deem appropriate, which is typically delete the content, remove the user, and in extreme cases, notify authorities that a user has gone bad. But the real interesting work is happening behind the scenes within the KB application servers. So let me explain the analysis and scoring a little bit more. First of all, we take in all types of user-generated content, text, videos, and images. And we also get the unique user ID from our customer. That gets sent over and is associated in our system with the items that have been uploaded. And it turns out that knowing a lot of information, as much as we can, about the user that's uploading the information is more important to our technology than looking at the individual pieces of content, which we do as well. Next, we automatically grade each piece of content against the typical abuse categories, such as cyberbullying, racism, and pornography. We continue to adjust the user's KB holistic score, looking at other signals from the social graph, such as their friend scores, community flags of their content, and their own past violations. the weights can be adjusted on a per-customer basis. For example, one of our customers has discovered that most of the pornography is uploaded by males ages 15 to 25 from a particular country. So we're able to bump up the KB score from that demographic in order to ensure that that content is more likely to be put up in front of the human moderators quicker. The KB system also learns over time and is able to get better at helping companies enforce their own particular terms of service. Since launching our system at the end of last year, KB's acquired 15 customers across the social network spectrum, and we are processing several million pieces of user-generated content per day with our tool. We're in conversations with virtually all established social networks, as well as quite a few startups that are safety-focused social networks that need a technology like ours in order to even launch their sites. Our goal is to have about 30 customers by the end of this year. So what does all this analyzing and scoring do to foster a safer social media environment? The bottom line is it allows social networks to remove most of the inappropriate content and users from their systems without having to actually look at all the content. This chart shows a couple of examples of this effect. In the upper example, 55% of the total content is reviewed, first by humans using only homegrown tools that don't prioritize the content, and second by humans using the KB solution. In this case, 72% more problematic content is found using KB. The effect is even more dramatic for a customer who can only look at 30% of their content. In this case, 179% more inappropriate content is found using this prioritization and scoring methods that I talked about. The other point on this slide is a little bit more qualitative. We found that a mid-sized social network using three moderators can successfully identify and remove 70 to 80% of the inappropriate content with three moderators. And by adding a fourth, they could significantly improve this, but ultimately they're gonna make a cost-benefit decision on that's based on what's appropriate for their community. Let me conclude by answering two questions in advance. First of all, KB is a Japanese word for sentinel or guardian. And second, our biggest challenge in our market is to get MySpace and Facebook as customers. Happy to take other questions.
Paul, thank you very much. Questions for KB? Let's see. Ah, great, Lam, start over there.
Thank you for your presentation. It's Lam Nguyen with Strauss Friedberg. I'm a TAB member. The screen you have up there talks about how effective KB can help in identifying additional bad content for the reviewers. Do you have any statistics on the amount of false positives that you're generating, and how does that help or dissuade your potential customers, because you're either asking them to review a lot more content that's not necessary to review, or is that a selling point of your product, and what are you telling your clients?
Yeah, well, we've done a fair amount of analysis. Again, we haven't been in the market that long, and we're starting to collect some pretty good data. But what we're finding is the techniques that I've described, and we actually have a patent pending on this aggregation of all these different signals, has the effect of bubbling up we'll call it the bad content to the top of the queue. So it's not so much a question of false positive, because there is subjectivity. Different social networks have different terms of service. You know, bikini-clad women are taboo in some and not in others. But by looking at these images, we're able to provide, to give them a head start and make them more productive. What we found, though, is that if a social network will look at about between 50 and 55%, I'll use images as an example, of all the images, they'll be able to remove about 87 to 90% of the problematic images across their entire network. So at about 50%, it gets close to the human error rate for another firm looking at 100% of the content.
Paul, thank you. I see both John and Teresa would like to speak, but others who have had less airtime, please.
Hi, I'm Ron from eGuardian. Just a question, what's been the biggest obstacle with when you've spoken to MySpace and Facebook? Is it getting in to talk to them, or is it just not a willingness to do this?
No, they both of those companies have a tremendous will to do this and get it right, but they also have significant development staffs of their own. So unlike the next tier of networks down, which would include the, you know, High Fives, Friendsters, and so on, those companies would probably rather not put their core developers onto doing systems like ours.
So tomorrow we'll hear from both MySpace and Facebook for anybody in a public session in the morning, and let's, if we can, just keep this more or less on the technical front, and we can ask those questions of them tomorrow.
They have a lot of engineers.
Thanks. Teresa, then John.
Actually, Lon asked my question. So
fabulous. Even better. John Morris of CDT. Nice work, Lon.
Thanks. So, what user information do you gather? And am I right in understanding that is the review happening on your servers or your customers' servers? So those are really two questions. How right. how much user information do you gather, keep, and how long do you keep it?
Okay, the only actual user information, as you described it, is an encrypted, unique user ID that we can't, that is, basically provides no identifiable information whatsoever. Now, having said that, the images that come into our system, which is hosted by us, we're a SaaS model, we have a subscription-based model, those images are analyzed within our servers. The results are delivered to the moderators, wherever they happen to be, and then the images are removed from our servers, typically within 30 days. We keep a thumbnail around for QA so that their moderators, managers, can go back and look at it and see if the right decisions were made.
Thanks, Paul. Others for KB? Excellent. All right. Thank you very much. Much appreciated.
Thank you.
Okay. Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Andrew Tate, and I'm the Director of Product Management at Spectrosoft Corporation. We're based out of Vero Beach, Florida. We've been in the monitoring business for quite some time, almost 10 years. And our products are very mature and really cater to parents who are, really have a concern about their children and what they're doing on their computers and on the internet. And I can tell you, the thing about education is so key, and it's really a challenge for everyone, especially parents, to find out, about these technologies, even though they may not be technically savvy. And that, I think we find that a lot at Spectrosoft when we're talking to our customers. They're just intimidated. So that drives us to create products that are very easy to install and very easy to use. I mean, the nature of the product itself is really dirt simple. And education is key on the parental side, but I think it's also very important on the child side. Just to give you an overview of our products, we'll get into that a little bit more in just a moment. We have several products on the consumer side. We also have an enterprise product that caters to businesses, and that's Spectre 360, but we won't go into that today. Our consumer products are Spectre Pro and eBlaster, and we also have Spectre for Mac. And I think we're one of the only companies currently providing a monitoring solution for Mac computers. The total deployment of our products are roughly 400,000 worldwide, and we record practically everything that they do on their computer. And that goes from their website visits to when they go to MySpace, who the pictures they're downloading. The keystrokes, everything they do, okay, chat, IM, the file downloads. They change something on their screen, for instance. I actually use the product for my own children. I have a 10-year-old at home and a 15-year-old. And recently, my 15-year-old had a Tommy gun, on his screensaver. And I saw this pop up. We actually record screen snapshots, and you can play them back in an application that has VCR-like controls, so you could do fast-forward or reverse it. Start over, replay, and every event has an associated action, so you can actually jump to the screen snapshot that surrounds those events and look and see what happened leading up to it. But getting back to the Tommy Gunn story, I have the relationship with my son such that I can go and talk to him. I have an open, line of communication. He knows he's being monitored. I said, this just doesn't look very good to have a machine gun on your screensaver, Jordan. What are you up to? And we talk about it, and it's a collaborative thing, and there's trust there. So I think, there's also the approach of not informing your child that you're monitoring them, and that's kind of difficult because when something does go wrong, how do you inform them that they're doing something wrong? And then at that point in time, they feel like they're being, there's some lack of trust there, and they feel like you don't belong on my computer. So I think I personally promote the fact that telling your child is important. We also have, step through this. We have been awarded several accolades throughout the press and industry, trade press. As you can see, there's PC Editor's Choice. Twice we've been awarded that, the Gold Award as well. And we continue to receive these accolades through time. And it's just testament to the maturity of the product. And again, the fact that it's so easy to install and simple to use, very intuitive. And just some of the things that Pro can do. If for instance, a child misrepresents themselves, okay, there are a lot of products, there are a lot of technology that we heard about today where it's preventing these type of things, or it's more of a blocking type thing. We're more into monitoring. If a child repeats these behaviors, the parent can see that. So, okay, they could go to that site once and maybe it was a mistake, but if they keep going to it day in and day out, we're going to show you that as a parent and then let you react accordingly. And we also have a product called eBlaster. I love eBlaster because my son is right now in Boca Raton, Florida, typing away, and I'm getting his eBlaster reports to my PDA. So no matter where I am in the world, okay, I'm able to keep in touch and connected to what my son's doing. Hey, Dad's on a business trip. I'm going to go to this website or I'm going to go to that website. No, I've got the PDA right here. I can see everything they're doing from a million miles away. So that's really a great feature of the eBlaster product is an intuitive report that's emailed to you, and it's very, very useful and very easy to understand and go through. The other thing that we do are keyword alerts. So, for example, if the child is typing in profanity or let's say your credit card number, okay, they go into mom's purse and pulls out the credit card and starts typing that away to buy some music or iTunes, for example, you get an alert and you can know right away and intervene. And so I think that's a really important feature as well. eBlaster as well has received several of these same awards. And just a recap of the features are on this slide, which are also included in your handout. Just as in summary, these are the products and also our Spectre Mac product as well. Any questions?
Andrew, thank you very much. Start with Scott Bradner and then Hani Farid and take it from there.
The same question asked earlier. Do you have any research to show how well parents stick to this, considering there's an awful lot of data potentially? How well they deal with this ongoing?
Well, in terms of they're staying with the product, you mean?
Staying with the actual responding to your messages.
Yeah, well, they do stay with it because we continually update them. And we know that we have a great rapport with our customers as follow-up. So we definitely see, the customers staying in touch and using the product through time because our product's right. Not static. It has to, it has to conform to, like, different events that occur or different features that are provided by mainly webmail. We see a lot of changes in webmail strings and that sort of thing. So, yes, we do find that customers stay with the product and are consistent over time.
Percentage-wise, you said you had 400,000 customers,
400,000 customers.
So what percentage of those have stuck with it for 6 months?
Oh, I would say probably close to 95%. I don't have any hard statistics, but it's definitely, we see a definite positive trend there.
Okay.
Thank you. Honey.
So we've been hearing a lot of the filtering and auditing and monitoring, and this is more of a clarification. It sounds like you're more in the monitoring. So there's no, like, you're just giving the parent all the information and let them deal with it. Or are you doing some, quote unquote, intelligent filtering? Because, a kid spends hours on a computer, and that can generate just a huge amount of data, especially if you're taking screenshots.
Well, it does, but the thing of it is that we categorize this data. So it's statistically presented to the parent.
So in some condensed format that doesn't take them an hour to sort through.
Well, for instance, like the websites, we give them top 10 reports of the top 10 websites that they've gone to or the top 10 chats that they've been participating in. And those are the type of statistics that parents are really after because they can go bubble up to the top, where are my kids spending the most of their time? And furthermore, we allow you to do blocking, okay, based on those sites. So for instance, if a child is going to a particular site that's not desirable, you can just say block the site from future access. And we do other have other controls as well, like block certain chat IDs or even provide times of when they can use the computer. For instance, if they come home, as soon as they get home from school, they start typing away, that's not desirable. So we give them, let's say, 6 to 8 at night that they can use their computer. And that's something that's built into the program as well.
Thank you.
Thanks, Andrew. Others, respect yourself. Yes, sir. Do we have a mic this way? Thanks. Start with the gentleman from NetNanny, then John Morris will get his question.
Just a quick question. Is there a way to prevent a child from installing this on their parents' computer to capture their admin password and stuff like that?
Well, this is all going back to the education thing. Okay, a parent shouldn't have their administrator password out in the open to a child. So you need administrative rights to do this, and I think that it's important that parents are educated and understand how to manage their computers. That's again part of this whole process, and I think a lot the people in this room are going to be key moving forward in making that knowledge available to the community at large.
John Morris, CDT.
Same question as before with other folks. How long do you keep all the data that the pretty massive amount of data that you're collecting, and do you do anything with it beyond?
Well, we don't house the data at SpectraSoft. All the data is, first of all, the eBlaster reports are relayed, so we don't store any data at SpectraSoft that's owned by the parent. The actual data itself that's hosted on the computer can be pruned back, and we provide tools for doing that. So it's really a configuration parameter.
So it's largely stored on the client machine?
Well, there is no client server approach here. I mean, this is the pro product. The user interface that the parent uses is on that computer, or they can install the viewer on a network, like a local area network. But that's just a viewer that's looking at shared files from the child's computer itself. So those files are resident there. eBlaster, again, is just a relay.
Blair, tell us who you are.
Hi, Blair Richardson from Aristotle. This is to follow up on a question that was asked earlier to the McGruff people, which is, do you have a mechanism to facilitate reporting of predatory contacts that a parent discovers through the use of your product?
No, we don't have a clearinghouse or any kind of relationship like the McGruff folks do, but we do provide very detailed, insight into the communication that's ongoing. So a parent can look at our reports, and it says, Johnny, let's go meet at the park tomorrow at 4:00, and then the parent can see that. And as a matter of fact, they could set up an alert, a keyword alert that says, meet me, or park, or after school, okay, or I'm your friend, or it could be any kind of string. And then immediately get an email alert. So they don't have to be looking through the logs all the time. It can just be, something that they're alerted on. And so it's really, we put the onus on the parent to do that. Because really, the clearinghouses aren't foolproof. There could be, what if the predator has changed their identity? And they often do, frequently, for that matter. And so in that case, nothing happened from the clearinghouse. And, there you go. The child's meeting the predator, and there's nothing. I mean, the parent has to be more involved. I mean, figure this. You go to a mall with your child. Do you let them go? They're 10 years old, let's say. You don't let them go run around the mall and then meet them an hour later. Why would you let them on the internet unsupervised? It's the same exact logic.
Sir?
Ross Cohen, been verified. Because you're monitoring everything, at what point do you feel like your software is just counterproductive and you're forcing the children to just go to their friend's house where they're not being monitored?
Well, when you say that, go over to the friend's house, I've thought of that quite a bit. And if your child is going to the friend's house, then you should know the parents of that friend. And you should have a nice long discussion with those parents to tell them the advantages of monitoring as well. So when they go over to the friend's house, their friend is also being monitored. I mean, again, it's education. Why let your child go over to a house where they can be, access to the wild, wild west? It's the same thing as the mall analogy. Don't let them roam around the mall unsupervised. And then the other thing that was discussed earlier is this trust level between the child and the parent. I think that's really an age you know, the age of the child really is key there. I mean, I'm going to let my 15-year-old go to maybe some promiscuous sites now and then. I mean, he's a guy, right? I'm going to let him grow up a little bit, you know. And back in my day, it was a Playboy magazine. Now it's whatever. Okay, so you give him a little leeway. But my 10-year-old, if I see him doing that, he's probably going to miss dessert for a week. So it's all about good parenting.
Larry Magid, last question, and then we will take a short break.
Seem to have toned down your marketing, but for the longest time, you were promoting your products for spying on spouses. In fact, I'm looking at press releases where you specifically say that. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering whether that's still part of your company's marketing, too.
No, it isn't. I mean, you know, you evolve and you mature as a company and over time. And I think from an ethics standpoint, we felt that was just something we don't really want to promote. I mean, obviously, first of all, we enforce the fact that the computer that our software is installed on has to be owned by the individual that is installing it. So that's key.
Technically own my wife's computer.
Okay, fine. You know. But that's something we're not preventing. I mean, we can't prevent you from doing that, but we're not encouraging you either. It's just a matter of maturing as a company. We feel that that's probably not.
So you have changed that aspect of your marketing.
We have.
Good.
We don't talk about that anymore.
Great, Andrew. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Michelle.
Okay. Great. Hello and good afternoon, and thanks to the committee for inviting us to speak today. So EthosSafe is a Boston-based company. We actually have offices in Lexington, but we're local folk. And what we're really focusing on is that we too focus on online content moderation, and we're really trying to remove the risk of user-generated content, our focus being to talk to brands about their social media programs. So for us, social media is online forums, their blogs, their wikis, their uploads of content of any kind, videos and photos, in addition to social networks. But we're really focusing our attentions right now on how the brands, mostly the large consumer brands, are using social media, and therefore keeping those particular UGC programs safe in relation to the ethos of that brand. So for instance, there will be many brands who will not necessarily have as high as standards about what is allowable in their UGC programs, and there are other brands that will be very strict about that. So essentially, we provide a turnkey solution to moderate any kind of user-generated content, and we are essentially a tagging and an analysis platform. So what we do is that we take content, a copy of content, into EthosSafe, and we tag it so that we can understand if that content is appropriate for the user-generated content or social media program that came. So our platform consists not only of technology, but of also human reviewers. So we have a technology where we have a smart database where we store the content that we get from all of the clients who use our platform. That smart database can understand if it's seen the content before, and I'll tell you in a minute how we do that. We also have a number of artificial intelligence components that is really doing the analysis. So we're doing simple things right now, word matching, spam filtering, profanity filtering, those kinds of understanding of text coming through. That is the area that we will expand probably the most in our technology platform, and that we can, because of the way the system is written, we can add all sorts of components into the technology platform so that we can analyze any kind of content that comes through the system. We also have 24/7 highly trained reviewers. So this is how it works. So this is the tagging platform that is EthosSafe. So content comes into EthosSafe, and at first we generate a digital fingerprint for that content. So that content, if it comes into our system many times, which is what we have found in our studies, is that inappropriate content that is generated by users is frequently, the bad stuff is frequently the same. So you know all about that, how it gets grassroots penetration and people pass it around. So if it comes into our system at any time, depending on where it comes from. If we've seen it, then that's going to make this process much faster. So we generate a digital fingerprint for each piece of content that comes in. We check our smart database to see if we've seen it before. If we have seen it before and it can tag the content appropriately for the client, then we send a message back that says in version one, it's a publish or no publish rule. In later versions, we can have any kind of variety of what happens with the instruction as it comes out of EthosSafe, but right now it's a publish and no publish rule. If we don't see the content in the smart database, we'll have technology take a look at the content that comes in. And if the technology can tag it in some way, then it will also send back the instruction back to the program that it came from. So what we're trying to do here is that each client of ours has their own set of rules. So we have a set of tags. We have about 50 to 60 tags that are standard tags. They all have to do with appropriateness or inappropriateness. So they could be sexual content, they could be hate language, they could be any kind of violence, and that's really what we're looking for in this first version. So we're really focusing on safety. So our clients choose which tags they want that are allowable on their site or not. So certain brands would not want any of that kind of content ever on their site, and other brands will have a lot more tolerance for certain things. So what we're doing in this tagging platform is that we're tagging each piece of content that comes in, and then we're comparing it to the rules of the client that we are working for. If the technology or the smart database cannot tag the content appropriately, then we will send it in front of human reviewers. So we have a platform and an interface for the human reviewers to do this very quickly. So it is an orchestration technology that comes in and presents this content right to our reviewers. And so it's a very quick, very fast process. And our differentiator here from other online content moderation plays is that we look at all of the content and that we are really focusing on a somewhat smaller type of social media program. We don't pretend to be able to handle all of MySpace or Facebook. We can handle a brand's portion of that. So if Adidas is putting up a Facebook page and they want it to be moderated, then we can moderate that for Adidas. But we are not trying to boil the ocean with all of Facebook and MySpace. We're really focusing on the brands. And these are the categories that the content is being tagged with. So again, it's really around safety. The system can handle any other kind of custom tags. So if a brand wants to do other kinds of tagging, we can do that. And we can do a publish or no publish rule on those as well. Okay. Any questions?
Great, Michelle. Another great, concise presentation. Wonderful. Thank you very much. I don't know if MySpace or Facebook have ever been compared to the ocean before, but now they are. This is good. Who has a question for Michelle? Teresa. Bless you.
Teresa Poloris from Polytechnic University of NYU. What sort of capabilities do you have to do that human moderation? You said that you had highly qualified people 24/7. I'm wondering, do you have people all over the world working three shifts to do this?
Yep, so actually we're using a virtual workforce model, so kind of a work-at-home model. Right now we're only covering the United States. We're a beta product, essentially, so we're covering the United States and English only right now. And so we will have reviewers in every time zone of the United States. The way that we currently have it set up is that it's four-hour shifts, so we're really trying to attract the educated at-home worker who may have other responsibilities, for instance, full-time mothers who can work during the day when their children are in school, or disabled people, or just people who want to work at home. And so people can work one shift or two shifts, but we will have enough people on board for 24/7 coverage.
And Michelle, just when you say you're a beta product, you are, though, in use at this point?
We are not in use. We are currently looking for beta customers.
Got it.
John, I just had a really quick follow-up question to that. How do you ensure the quality and consistency
Good
of
question.
The human reviewers?
Right. That was so, it. So our system is really set up as a checks and balances. So we have supervisors on board who will also be doing spot checking. And the way that we have the reviewers set up is that we have more reviewers than we need for each shift, so that frequently we send content through the system more than once so that we can check on tagging. And so we're trying to make sure that the content is seen by multiple people so that we can make sure that we are getting consistent tags. We also have a pre-testing, so in order to get hired, you have to show computer literacy, obviously, and also some other tests that our chief operating officer is providing.
Thank you. Good questions. Others for Michelle? You feel safe. Brian.
Brian Levine from UMass Amherst. So yep. Is it a technical limitation, or does it have to do with the fact that you're using a human workforce that you couldn't scale up to something the size of the largest social networking sites? Or is it a business decision?
It's really kind of a business decision. We started the business to answer the needs of clients that we had, and it kind of really took off from there. It's very hard to tell if the ethos of Facebook and MySpace in general will actually embrace full across-the-board content monitoring, and it may not be our job to do that. There are other places that are doing it. As KB, who is one of our competitors, mentioned earlier, Facebook and MySpace are actually building those systems probably themselves. So what we're really focusing on is helping brands move into the social media space.
Do you mind if I ask another question?
Please, Brian, thank you.
So given that you're going to have lots of customers that have their own sites with these different discussions and that you're going to look at user content, are you going to tag users across different sites? And if you do, where do you keep that information? Who is it available to? Is it deletable upon user request, et cetera, et cetera?
Right. I'm going to have Eric Marthinson, my chief architect, come up and answer that question.
Sure. So So the content that comes in, are you talking about tagging content or users across sites or content
exactly.
across sites?
Users. Content, tagging users across sites and then...
Yeah, we do optionally capture information regarding the users that contribute content. So the brand can pass through anything from a unique user ID, which is kind of site-specific, to an email address, to a username. And we can use that to try and trend across different sites. In the beta version, we're not doing that right now. We're just capturing the information. But we do have that capability, and we do have the data store built for that.
So do you plan to sell that information to third parties?
No.
Would you notify those users if there was a breach of your security?
Of our security?
Yeah.
We would probably pass that back to the brands. Uh-huh. We operate as a white label service, so to a large degree, we're invisible to the end user.
And what kind of information are you capturing about them? Is it just their email? Are you capturing their IP address and information?
Yeah, the specific fields that we're capturing would be a user ID, user ID, email address, IP address, and I think that's it. All that information is optional, so the brand has control over whether they want to send that to us or not, and it is deletable upon user request.
Upon your client's request, not the user request.
Yeah. Okay. The user would never know of us, but
right. Okay.
Thanks, Brian. Other questions? John Morris.
I'm going to yell it out. How long do you keep the data that you're going to capture on individual users?
Right now, indefinitely.
It's an honest answer. There it is.
Part of our solution is that the smart database, which is keeping that content, and as future versions come out, we will also be doing analysis on that, like Bayesian filters and those kinds of things, to make that database smarter, so that when content comes in, we can recognize it more easily.
Scott Bradner.
So even Google is back down from forever. Why are you starting out with forever? That seems to be a remarkably dumb thing to do.
Yeah. Scott Bradner's email address? Oh, no, I won't even tell you.
Just tell me what his car looks like. The it might be. I think one of the reasons that we're not addressing a specific retention policy is because we haven't had any pushback about the fact that we do retain the data indefinitely. If that were to bubble up, I think we would address it. And we are starting to look at this more and more.
Yeah, consider this pushback.
Duly noted.
But you just said that the user would never know about it. I mean, they're a white label thing, so it's invisible. So unless you're part of your requirements is that the people you work for publicize to their customers what's going on, they would never know, so you wouldn't have the opportunity to figure out how much people love it, if that's the right term.
How much people love it. Yeah, we do address the issue of transparency in our own documents. And I believe I need to double check on this, but I believe part of our terms of service is that we ask for something to be included in the privacy policy regarding how they're moderating their content and our involvement. So on a day-to-day basis, we're not communicating directly with a customer. We would love it if the sites put a little, made safe by EthoSafe badge on our site. We're not counting on that. But we do ask that they address our involvement in their privacy policy.
Yeah, part of our contract with the brands is that they would put that it is being moderated by a third party, and so it would be in part of their privacy statement.
Hi.
Great, one last question.
Just for clarification.
Doug, can you tell us, please?
Doug Krugman, Protocol Partners. Most of the data we're talking about here is publicly posted user-generated data.
Yes.
Why are we so concerned about the privacy of this data?
Right. I'm not. Why would we be concerned about that?
If indeed it's only that, it's not published in a context which is questionable, a private quote private space or something like that, then it's probably not an issue. But making things making it clear as to what you're doing is an issue.
Right, I agree.
It's certainly a significant concern and has been expressed to be a significant concern of creating databases of people's actions that can later come back to haunt them.
Yep. So just remember that we're not there. I suppose you could say there were actions, but it is really the content that we're most interested in, and so it is optional from the brand and from our clients to decide if we're also capturing this personal information about people. So
if you allow me to add to that, Scott, part of the problem is that they said they were collecting, you said you were collecting information from multiple sites of users who would not be linked otherwise. And so now my activities across the whole entire internet are in one database. And on one site I may have found it acceptable to give my email, and on another site I may have posted an anonymous question, but now somehow I'm linked together. And especially if you didn't say that you're not tracking children. So if you're tracking someone's activities when they become 18, it's still in this database forever. And somehow, then I'll go out for a job interview, and I'll then ask this company to produce all the postings I ever had as a child, and suddenly I'm responsible for things maybe I shouldn't be.
Very helpful exchange. Do you guys want a final word on this, and then we'll sure. Move to icouldbe.org?
We our technology in terms of tracking users across sites is not particularly sophisticated. We're looking at email addresses, usernames. So the only opportunity we would have to link somebody is if they use the same information. If somebody posts anonymously on one site and posts posts under a username on another site, we really can't match them up. We could try to do it by IP address, but that's extremely unreliable. So I would consider that to be junk data.
It's pretty reliable. And a lot of the sites request an email address and then don't present it out in public, but you would have that information. And you'd have to keep a record of that. This was a site where I just think you should keep it in mind.
No, I think that
it's pretty important.
Really good.
Yeah, I agree.
For us right now in our conversations with the clients that we're talking to, it isn't an issue for them. And so we're, of course, catering to sort of getting the feedback from them. But this is a great conversation for us.
I suspect
that
some of the technical advisory board and others would be happy to give you a bit of free consulting on how long data retention policies ought to be.
Please. Sound like you have strong opinions about it.
There are some
so.
Good and strong opinions, and lots of others at the Berkman Center who think long and hard about this, who I'm sure would be happy
great.
To talk to you about
Excellent.
It. Awesome. Please join me in thanking EthoSafe.
Thank you.